Pseudopod, episode 91, May 23rd, 2008. This week's story, Caesar's Ghost by UG Foster. Welcome to Pseudopod, the weekly horror podcast. I'm your host, Alistair Stewart, and this week's story comes to us from UG Foster, a writer who has been around these parts before and whose work is as varied as it is consistently impressive. You can find UG at ugfoster.com, whilst this story was originally published in Revenant, a horror anthology put out by Carnifex Press. Your narrator this week is Kat Rambo, another profoundly impressive writer whose work can be found at kittywampus.net. Both those sites are well worth clicking on, believe me. In the meantime, put the kibble out and make sure the bowls are clean, because I have a story for you, and I promise you, it's true.
Caesar's Ghost by UG Foster. I saw my dead ferret, Caesar, last night in my living room. I dozed off watching reruns on TV and woke up to the tickle prick of whiskers against my hand. When I looked down and saw him, I picked him up and settled him under my chin. We'd always slept like that on the couch, him nestled against me, a warm weight rising and falling as I breathed. I closed my eyes and remembered. Caesar was dead. I sat up, bang, and he was gone. I told Richard about it the next morning at work. "I think my ferret's haunting me," I said, hoping to start things on a light note after our rocky parting the previous evening. "Don't be ridiculous, Kathy," he snapped back. It was the first time he'd ever been sharp with me. An awkward silence sprang up and clocked in for the long haul. I met Richard several months after Caesar's death. He was new to RISCOM, and I was his mentor. I think my boss was trying to keep me away from customer service duties until he was sure I was stable. Some people can shrug off a pet's death. "It's just a dog, or cat, or parrot," they say. I cried myself sick when Caesar died. One day he was fine. The next he'd stopped eating. 3 months, hand feedings that turned into force feedings, a dozen tests, an ultrasound, and an unsuccessful surgery later, and the tumors had grown so big you could feel them inside him. Firm, lumpy mounds, when you picked him up. When we ran out of things to try, I was there, insisted on it, as the vet put the little gas mask over Caesar's soft face and pushed the needle full of pink death into his heart. Caesar went so quickly, like he'd been waiting for an excuse. I broke down, crying those ugly, broken sobs that rip through you, the kind that only get worse if you try to stop them. People should take time off when someone they love dies. I crashed our main server, sent a client to our top competitor, and lost a week's worth of documentation on the network drives before my boss called me in and sent me home, sick. He had a dog. Maybe he understood. Then I met Richard. We went to the movies, had dinner at romantic places, and kissed goodnight. It was uncomplicated and comfortable, what I needed. Until last night. We went to Romeo and Juliet and out for coffee after. Over almond gâteau and lattes, he presented me with a huge rock of a ring. It was so unexpected. I was stunned, dumbfounded. I told him I didn't know. I needed to think about it. We parted on my doorstep, tangled in a knot of ungainly silence. I fell asleep in front of the TV, fretting. Of course Caesar's visit had been a dream, a conjured memory of comfort and reassurance, but it had felt so real. Richard and I didn't talk again until after lunch, a lunch I spent alone and miserable, eating a sandwich at my desk from the cafeteria. I looked up from a program I was testing when he cleared his throat. "Kathy, I'm sorry." He leaned against the divider wall between our cubes, with his slightly too long russet curls waving around his face, and his soft brown eyes looking mournful and contrite. "I didn't mean to rush you. Can we forget about last night?" "Could we?" The surge of relief left me lightheaded. "Consider it forgotten. We still on for tonight?"
"Definitely."
Richard and I spent the day striving for the effortless flirtation we'd had before. I laughed at his quips and chatted with him over the wall. But our interactions were forced, like we were trying too hard. I was a twist of clenched muscles when 4:30 finally crept up and Richard turned off his computer. "See you at 7," he called. I twitched, tried to repress it. Yup. I needed a chance to unkink, so I swung by the grocery store. Some people exercise to unwind. Others get loopy at happy hours. Me, I go for groceries. Ordered rows of vegetables, dry goods, dairy products, so soothing and cozy. I debated with myself as I picked over the celery and carrots. Richard loved me. How many other opportunities would I have? True, I hadn't known him for long, but what did that matter? The question was, did I love him? I'd never been in love. Not the sort of love you see in movies where the heroine rides horses along the beach. Maybe that sort of love didn't exist outside of Hollywood. Maybe I was holding Richard to a lofty illusion. Here I was, in my mid-30s, the only close friend I'd had in the last 8 years, a domesticated polecat. And when an attractive, intelligent man asked me to marry him, I froze. I liked Richard. Maybe even loved him. Yet, still undecided, I drove home, laden with brown paper bags. He showed up as I chopped celery and grated cheese into a crock pot, a pile of movies under one arm, and a cluster of red roses in the other. All my doubts faded in a bouquet of soft petals and perfumed blossoms. They're beautiful! Not nearly as beautiful as you. Richard pulled me in for a kiss. It was clumsy, my hands dusted with strands of sharp cheddar, and Richard crushing me against him. Still, it was nice. The microwave tinged. We came apart breathlessly. I left Richard to put the videos in the television room while I went to find a vase for the roses. The barley simmered, a bubble of earthly savor, with a smell of onions, a cozy counterpoint. I set the potatoes to microwave for another minute. While I got the glass vase from over the fridge, I heard scrabbling. It reminded me of when a mouse appeared during a particularly brutal winter. Caesar had been fascinated by tiny corners under the sink where I found bits of chewed drywall and wood. The mouse departed furtively before my half-formed plans of traps and cheese ever came to fruition. I juggled the vase of roses as I opened the sink doors, hunting for telltale mouse debris. The scratching grew louder. I drifted around the kitchen, listening. It seemed to come from behind the refrigerator, then the cupboards. I expected to see a small, furred body scurry out. The timer dinged and the scrabbling reached a frantic pitch. At the edge of my vision, I saw movement within the dark interior of the microwave. I realized, with a sick churning in my stomach, where the sound was coming from. My hand trembled as I hit the open button. Between the mounds of potato, a large, furred body slumped. It was far too large to be a mouse. It looked like a rat, a big rat. The stench of burnt fur wafted to me, and underneath it the pungent smell of roasted flesh. I pulled the potato away, burning my fingers, and turned the dish carousel. The animal spasmed and mewled. It wasn't a rat. I saw it clearly in the yellow microwave light, the bandit markings across the eyes, the delicate ears and soft brown nose. I recognized them instantly. It was Caesar. I screamed and dropped the vase of roses. It shattered on the floor, the flowers spilling out. I couldn't look away. Caesar's eyes bubbled in his skull. A fine smoke rose from his fur. I couldn't stop screaming. The next thing I remembered, Richard was shaking me while I wept hysterically. In the microwave, Caesar's frying in there. A vet. We need a vet. Richard shook me. Your ferret is dead. He enunciated each word as though I was a child. You didn't microwave him. He turned me to face the microwave. See? There's nothing. I stared, tears blurring my vision. There were several brown potato shapes, but nothing furry, nothing writhing in agony. There was an animal in there. I'm certain it was a ferret. I have to find him. I pulled away so I could get down on all fours. Richard stopped me. Kathy, how long do you think the animal was in there? A minute. I checked the potatoes. It must have snuck in before I started the last round. I scanned the floor amidst the scattered roses. On high? Yes. No animal is going to be able to crawl out of a microwave after that long. Their insides would cook. They'd be dead. But, Kathy... There was no animal. I saw. It was a hallucination. Your imagination. The floor was coated in broken glass and trampled roses. If an animal had jumped down in the state I'd seen, it couldn't have gone far. It would be suffering, and it would be blind. I went limp in Richard's arms. It was awful, terrible, I babbled. Richard stroked my hair. He let me sob, being the rock I hadn't known I'd needed. Dinner was ruined, of course. Richard suggested we go out, but I couldn't cope with the idea of people or food, so we called it a night. As I cleaned away the broken glass and threw out the ruined flowers, I wandered back to the microwave, looking for something, bits of fur maybe, or little paw marks. I found nothing. I couldn't sleep. Images of Caesar's boiling, melting eyes appeared in the darkness behind my closed eyelids. I ached to hold him in my arms. He'd always known when I was frightened or lonely. He'd clamber up the blankets and settle beside my head on the pillow. But Caesar was in ferret heaven, and that was that. Probably digging up St. Peter's flower beds and stealing his sandals. Remembering Caesar's penchant for shoes and his war against anything potted made me grin. I closed my eyes and counted ferrets thieving footwear. It relaxed me enough to start shuttling between states of consciousness, not awake, but drifting above the deep quietude of slumber. Hovering there, on the brink of sleep's gentle void, I smelled Caesar's fur. A clean ferret smells like a baby blanket, clean and sweet and soft. My pillow shifted. As I tumbled down into the empty places reserved for dreams, I felt Caesar's whiskers brush my face. In the morning, I searched my pillow for traces of sable fur. I found several strands of my own coiling blonde hair, but nothing else. In the shower, I resolved to have no more thoughts of ferrets. I'd mourned long and hard for Caesar. Enough was enough. Richard had coffee and a bagel waiting for me at my cube. "How are you doing?" he asked. I smeared strawberry jelly on a half-honey wheat bagel. "Aside from feeling terrible about ruining our evening, I'm fine." "I was wondering, since Monday didn't work out and the tapes aren't due till tomorrow, want to try again tonight?" I smiled shyly. "You must be the most tolerant man I've ever met." "Is that a yes?" I laughed. "Yes." "My place this time. I'll make my fabulous marinara sauce with baked ziti." After work, I showered and selected my outfit carefully. Something soft and pretty for Richard, for being so understanding. I chose a scoop-necked silk blouse in a rich shade of mulberry. My black velvet slacks accentuated the deep color, and I had a perfectly matched set of mulberry pumps. Except I couldn't find them. I looked in the closet, under the bed, and in the bathroom, but no luck. 6:30 ticked by, and I was in a profound state of miffed. Giving up, I substituted a black pair of heels. They would do. I was about to leave when I discovered my keys were missing. That topped it. I wanted to stomp my feet and yell. It was so typical. Or rather, it had been typical when Caesar was alive. Then I saw in my mind's eye, clear as yesterday, an industrious ferret sifting through my purse, discovering the shiny, seductive cluster of keys and doing what came naturally to ferret kind, swiping them. My mouth tasted like sand, and icicles sheathed my spine. A fine hairline tremor racked my hands as I got on my knees before the couch, the place where Caesar had delighted in secreting away his stolen treasures. It was dark beneath, as it does tend to be under couches. I squinted into the shadows, inhaling the dust from the carpet in shallow pants. Thrusting my hand in, my fingertips grazed a firm, smooth rim. I yanked. It was one of my mulberry pumps. I stared at it, struggling not to jump to absurd conclusions. I'd taken them off in the living room, and they had gotten shoved underneath the couch. That was all. I reached for the other one. I swept my hand around until I nudged a hard, jagged object that jingled. Even before I saw it, I knew what it was. My keys. I couldn't rationally explain how my keys had gotten there and quit trying. Instead, I lifted the couch's skirt and peered in. An inch from my nose, a whiskered, bandit-masked muzzle lunged at me. Caesar was under the couch. He'd thought it was a game when I raided his plunder nest. He'd wait for me and pounce at my hands and face with his little paws. Except Caesar was dead. I told myself that as I ran to the kitchen and tore open the drawer where I kept the flashlight. I hunkered back to my knees beside the couch. It illuminated my missing shoe, shoved as far back against the wall as possible, but nothing else. If there was a ferret under my couch, I would have seen him. I clicked off the light and sat up. "I am not being haunted by my dead ferret," I told myself. "Repeat it, Kathy. I am not being haunted by my dead ferret." I heard a quiet padding underneath the couch. Like paws. Exactly like paws. "You aren't Caesar," I shouted. "Go away." I screamed it as loud as I could. "Go away." Silence. I didn't wait for the noise to restart. Keys in hand, I bolted. It wasn't until I hit the freeway that I stopped trembling. I decided as I walked up Richard's driveway that I wouldn't bring up this latest testament to my instability. When Richard opened the door, he found me grinning, putting as much spring into my step as I could without bouncing out of orbit. Richard's house was a masculine place, full of dark wood and mismatched furniture. I sniffed the air. The thick aroma of baking oregano, balsamic vinegar, and Roma tomatoes permeated the house. "It's almost ready," he said, noting my appreciation. "Great, I'll go wash up." Richard's bathroom was the neatest, cleanest bathroom I've ever been in, including my own. I didn't know men disinfected. Maybe he did it to impress me. I was fixing my makeup when I heard it. A soft coughing coming from the bathtub. Pushing the curtain back, I saw a tiny kitten, blood-splattered and drenched, convulsed on the gleaming porcelain. It was crunched and battered, like it had been broken inside. It wheezed, a piteous, feeble sound. Blood speckled its muzzle. "Richard!" I screamed. "Richard!" He came running, and I turned to him when he barged in. "There's a kitten in your bathtub," I whispered. "Hurt bad." He shoved past me. I flinched my eyes back to the tub. It was empty, shining white and unblemished. Richard glowered. "I am getting mighty sick of all your accusations and mind games, Kathy." "What? But..." A strange gleam filled his eyes, oily and fierce. "I thought you were different." "What are you saying? I didn't..." There was nothing in the tub now, but I suddenly knew, once upon a time, Richard had seen what I had seen. "You killed that kitten!" I stumbled back, trying to put space between us in the shiny, clean room. "That's monstrous!" It happened so quickly. Richard's fist caught me, and I went down, black lights flashing before my eyes. I couldn't have been out for long. The smell of marinara still hung in the air. I sat upright in a high-backed chair in his bedroom, my hands and feet bound, and a sticky, tight swath of duct tape over my mouth. I was trussed, hand and foot, with the stuff. Richard loomed over me, watching. "Good, you're awake. I thought I might have hit you too hard." It was the same voice he'd said good morning and have a good evening with. "Dinner is almost done." Terror was an icy hand in my gut. I looked away, couldn't bear to meet his friendly, insane eyes. Beside Richard, a pair of shiny, liquid brown orbs gleamed in the shadows. They were low, coming to his knees. As I watched, the orbs resolved into a pair of eyes. It was a dog, a Cocker Spaniel mix, I'd guess, from the curly ears. Except it was wrong. Its neck was twisted around so its head was crooked, and a jagged sliver of bone jutted from one of its front legs. Richard didn't notice, just kept talking. "I'm sorry, Kathy, I love you. I want us to be together. But you've been sneaky, talking to people behind my back. I would have explained if you'd come to me first." The dog trotted forward and sat up, resting its front paws on my chair. It hurt to see it put weight on its shattered leg. Its head cocked further, a caricature of the quizzical pose dogs are so good at. Richard continued to ignore it. "I want us to talk, so I'm taking the tape off over your mouth. Don't scream, okay? I hate screaming." I nodded. Ever so carefully, he peeled the sticky mess off. It still hurt, and it left a residue of gluey, sour-tasting gum on my lips. The dog barked. Richard gave no indication he'd heard it. "Besides," he said, beaming maniacally, "you wouldn't be able to eat my baked ziti with your mouth covered." "Richard, please let me go." I tried to keep the shakes out of my voice, but my words came out broken and wobbly. "My arms hurt." "Until we've had our talk, you need to stay put. Otherwise, you might get troublesome. I can't abide a troublemaker." He rested a hand ever so gently against my neck. It was a travesty of a lover's caress, and I flinched away. His eyes unfocused and his fingers tightened, clenching around my throat. Agony ringed my neck. I couldn't inhale, couldn't breathe, couldn't scream. The pressure built, huge and overwhelming. Richard strangled me, crushing my windpipe. I was going to die, and there wasn't a thing I could do about it. In the other room, I heard the buzz of the stove timer. He released me. Pain exploded from my neck, throbbing and sharp, like I'd tried to swallow a spike and it had lodged in my throat. I coughed. It was a ragged sound. It reminded me of the kitten in the bathtub. "There we go," he said. "Dinner's done. Behave now. I'll be right back." Then I was alone, alone with my pain and a mangled dog. I tried to free my hands. The tape was both strong and tacky. It twisted, but wouldn't tear or break. The dog watched me with its eerie, trusting eyes. "Hi, boy," I choked out. A wet, ruined kitten appeared. It didn't walk in. It was simply there, where before there had been nothing. I recognized it from the bathtub. Beside it, an orange tabby cat materialized. Half of its fur was burnt away, leaving charred skin and black patches. It leaped onto my lap and rubbed its side against me. I recoiled from the feel of brittle, burned fur. "Nice kitty," I whispered. "Want to gnaw on the tape? Save me from the insane man?" The cat curled on my lap, purring. I could feel its warmth, a fevered heat pressed into me, but it didn't seem interested in, or capable of, doing squat about the tape. The dog barked again. I glanced down in time to see the manifestation of Caesar. A golden mist shimmered, coalesced, and ejected my ferret. He darted to my chair, scaled my pant leg, navigated around the cat, which purred louder, and put his little paws on my right arm. "Good boy," I whispered. "Chew through the tape, boy." Caesar gave me a disdainful look. Ferrets don't have the incisors rodents do. Caesar could have punctured the tape with his sharp fangs, but chew through it? Not in an hour's time. He hopped away, landing with the clumsy bump-thump ferrets and their short legs are prone to, and scampered off. "Wait," I whispered. "Come back." And he did. He returned, scooting along backwards, dragging something beneath his body. I'd seen Caesar drag a heavy wool scarf under the couch like that. This time he had something better, a pair of scissors. The shiny metal blades were as long as he was. He brought them to my feet and sat expectantly. He had that look on his face he often got when he tried to explain something to me in ferret ease that I simply wasn't bright enough to catch on to. Of course, a ferret could drag a pair of scissors, but there was no way he was climbing with them. Understanding what I needed to do, I rocked from side to side. The cat sprang off as the chair legs lifted, first one side, then the other. I built up momentum until I toppled over, knocking into a wooden dresser with a thunderous crack. "What are you doing in there, Kathy?" I heard Richard's footsteps. The sound was ice water in my face. Caesar gripped the scissors in his mouth and, with a great effort, lifted. He carried them, slipping and half-tripping the few inches to my hand. My fingers grabbed the metal as the door banged open. Richard stood there, still in his apron. "You're being troublesome, Kathy." "I warned you not to be troublesome, didn't I?" His face contorted. I fumbled, trying to open the scissors and press the edges against the tape. In a blur of patchy fur, the burned cat hurtled between us, yowling and hissing. Richard's eyes widened. He saw her. The scissors weren't sharp, and the tape was gummy. I sawed, feeling them cut, but so slow. My hand cramped. I ignored the shooting spasms. The cat flung itself at Richard's face. He tore it off, and I saw bright red scratches scoring his cheeks. He heaved the cat into a wall. It slid to the floor, a boneless puddle of fur, and disappeared. Richard reached for me and stumbled. The kitten had launched itself at his feet. He stomped hard, crushing it into the carpet. When his foot came up, the kitten was gone, too. I'd freed my hand, but the other was still mucked up. The dog growled and stalked forward. I watched, frantically cutting the last fibers of tape, as Richard kicked the dog in the side and twisted its head around. Vertebrae crunched, and the dog faded away. My hands were free, and I could stand, though I was still trapped, my legs taped to the chair. "You were very bad," Richard said. Droplets of blood smeared his face and dribbled into his eyes. I swung the scissors up, aiming for his face, his eyes, anything that would stop him. The chair tangled my legs. He caught my hand, trapped my wrist in his, and with his other backhanded me across the jaw. A sunburst of pain flared across my face. I fell back, sprawled against the overturned chair. I clung to the scissors, refusing to let go, even when it felt like Richard was grinding the bones in my wrist to powder. He shouted, and his hold on my wrist loosened. I wrenched free. He fell against me as I shoved the points of the scissors as hard as I could. In the petrified silence, I lay there, Richard's weight pinning me, not daring to move. My face and wrist throbbed, and the edges of the chair jabbed into my side. Richard didn't get up, didn't stir. He was a dead weight as I rolled him over. The hilt of the scissors protruded from his chest, buried by the force of his fall and my final effort. At his leg, beneath his hamstring, a small, brown-furred specter clung. Caesar had sunk his jaws into Richard, and like his weasel and mink ancestors, had locked his jaws. He eyed me around a mouthful of flesh. "You can let go," I gulped. He waited another second before dropping off. I picked him up and he licked the tears off my face. He waited with me as I dissolved into a shivering, weeping mess. When I could function again, I cut my legs free and called 911. Caesar disappeared somewhere between my broken pleas for help and reciting Richard's address. One moment I was holding a slinky, furred body in my arm. The next I was holding air. The police didn't keep me long, thank God. I guess the ugly red wheal on my neck and the spreading bruise on my face were pitiful enough. All I wanted was to go home and cower in my safe, warm bed. But once in my sanctuary, I discovered it wasn't the refuge I needed. There I had curled up with Richard, and there I had cooked him dinner. And on the settee in the television room, I had let him kiss me. I shivered in bed with all the lights on, and still I couldn't close my eyes. As though on cue, when I needed comforting the most, Caesar came. I heard his claws on the blankets as he pulled himself up. His little head poked over the edge of the bed, and he clambered into my arms, the most comforting thing in the world, warm and soft and alive. I closed my eyes and inhaled the sweet, clean scent of his fur. When I opened them, my bed was full of animals. The Cocker Spaniel mix lay at my feet, his tongue lolling to the side. Another ferret, the mirror image of my Caesar, bounded among the blankets. A cat purred in a warm mound of orange fur and golden eyes, and a tiny kitten waved its tail back and forth like a flag. All of them were beautiful and whole. No broken limbs, no burns, no hurts. I stroked their sleek coats and basked in their adoration. "Thank you," I whispered. "Thank you." One by one, they accepted my gratitude and my caresses before fading away like the memory of a dream. Only Caesar remained, clutched like a treasured stuffed animal in my arms. He began to squirm. "Don't leave," I whispered. "Please, please don't go." He peered up at me with his round black eyes. I bent my head until I could feel his whiskers flutter against my cheeks. Tears made his fuzzy, lustrous shape shimmer and waver. A single hot drop fell on his muzzle, and he sneezed in my face. I had to laugh. Caesar closed the last distance between us and swiped his tongue once, twice, over my nose. He was reassuring me, and truly I felt better, comforted by the kisses of a ferret. He grew faint, misty transparent, and he was gone. I wrapped my arms around my legs and rocked myself in my bed until dawn gleamed through the curtains over my window. I think I'll stop by the animal shelter today. It's time to adopt another fuzzy-headed mischief maker. Or maybe they'll adopt me.
You get used to death in a rural community. Yes, this is the most cheerful outro ever. Thank you for noticing. Seriously though, living in an agricultural area means that you see a lot of animals, and a lot of the time, a lot of the animals you see, you end up eating. However, there's a compassionate edge to that pragmatic view which never ceased to surprise me. Give you a case in point. A girl I went to school with was the daughter of the deputy headmaster. This being a tiny community, the deputy head was also a farmer, a lifeboat officer, and an award-winning photographer. Lambing season, he could barely get through the school day, because on either side of it he'd have hours of work, making sure the sheep were all safe, the lambs all cared for, and so on. One year, a couple of lambs were born with dystrophy in their back legs, and his daughter, who remains one of the toughest people I've ever met, refused to let them be put down. She worked with them, patiently, every single day, to try and get their legs stronger, and it worked, not much, but enough. Temper that with the realization that the mountain rescue and lifeboat teams would rescue sheep and dogs more than humans, and it becomes clear that even in pragmatic agricultural communities, animals occupy a position closer to the heart than we'd like. They need us, certainly. Apart from cats, I'm with Eddie Izzard on cats and their secret drilling and rubber band flicking, but on some level, we need them too. Or as my best friend put it in conversation with me earlier today, pets are for life, not unlife. Pseudopod is staffed by a crack team of fiction commandos, led by Ben Phillips, fronted by Alistair Stewart, I get the horrible feeling that makes me face, you know, and backed by Ellen Allen, our slash reader. And when not hiding out in the LA underground, and how great is it, by the way, that LA actually has an underground service now, we rely on you to pay our authors, so if you liked this story, please go to pseudopod.org and click on Feed the Pod. Every cent is appreciated. Pseudopod is a production of Escape Artists Incorporated and is released under a Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. And Pseudopod, the air just caught on fire. There's not going to be a lull.